Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Are you up for it?
We've been here before, of course, many times. The title of the piece is announced several minutes after it starts, so an atmosphere has already built up before you are aware of the locale in which the action is set, or to the true nature of what will unfold. Already, you've been beguiled by, say, the flickering white lines of a lonely road seen at night from the rain-swept window of a fast-moving car. Time measured by the rhythm of the windscreen wipers. Line after line after line. White marks which twitch in the raindrops in infinite blackness. Or by the zany kaleidoscope of fractured bedroom windows which emerge and flicker on the edge of consciousness as the express train that carries you homewards plunges on into the chasm of darkness. The title of the piece is still pretty ambiguous, and you cannot yet be sure whether you're going to be hurled into the midst of tragedy, a black comedy, or some kind of faux folk whimsy with dark undertones of the Brothers Grimm or Quay. Could be postmodern. Could be emotionally naked with a powerful whiff of raw sincerity. The sort that rejects all of the postmodern posturing as crap, pure and simple. Could be wholly reactionary, but with a sufficient veneer of postmodern styling to delude the unsuspecting punter. It could be all, or none of these. Could be entirely clueless, or it could be the next evolutionary stage for human endeavor, a blueprint for all that will follow in its magnificent wake. But don't hold your breath. Although, of course, you've been waiting a while now for that elusive title to be announced, you're not exactly intrigued as to who penned it. Maybe the same interest you'd have in the name of a captain of an aeroplane. If that, after all, in that situation, the best you can hope for is that his name be somehow mildly amusing, a puerile distraction from the fact that you're placing your life in the hands of a complete stranger whose face you'll never see.
I'm Captain Ed Balls, and my number one is Dominic Prick.
That kind of thing. But the title. Ah, the title. This title that surely holds real promise. Here it comes. After a longish pause for extra gravitas.
Tracy's Dilemma by J. M. Bentley. Cavalier Attitudes by Catherine Hardy. Among the Warrior Tribe by Benedict Foy.
Well, whatever, as they say, more and more I find. The point being, the title still doesn't tell you anything, and you never heard of the author, even when it's pointed out later that it's a modern classic or something. It's one you missed. You must have been on holiday when it was announced in the Sunday papers. Reviewed by one of those people who only exist in the pages of the Sunday papers. Funny how you never seem to see any of the books they write about. It could even constitute a low-level conspiracy, one which might be doing the rounds on the internet even now. The names of the writers of these dramatic works on offer. They don't bear any comment at all. Those that sound like pseudonyms are all real. The real ones sound like they're fakes. You need a little more information, clearly. A strapline, so you know whether irony, quotation, what have you, whatever, is intended or not. A thumbnail description would arise naturally. A plot would unfold in your mind straight off if only you had a bit more of a clue. Would flow forth as if the narrative were a living thing. Like a greyhound, its course clear in your mind, moving instinctively and inevitably.
Tracy's Dilemma by J. M. Bentley.
A telling and timely story of love, race and betrayal. Cue authentic inner city accents. A brutal encounter in an Asda car park. The coppers come round. One of them is quite sensitive. What? Turns out he knew her dad way back. What's going on, Tracy? For God's sake, what's going on? They stare at one another across the detritus of the breakfast table that has never seen a proper home-cooked meal. He's moody. Perhaps he is the Tracy of the title. Chief Inspector Colin Tracy. His wife has left him, the cow. Or she died, leaving him with a daughter that would be her age. He says would be, because in truth, she ran off to London when her mum passed away. He hasn't seen her since. She must hate his guts. All his efforts to trace her have been in vain. And him, a copper. Naturally, he wants to reach out to her, to this girl he encounters with all of her ill fortune. She reminds him of the other one. Of course she does. Naturally, he wants to reach out and touch her. That's what you might reasonably expect.
Do you love me?
You know, I like you. Like you a lot.
But do you love me?
You have to sit through all this muck, even though it happens in real life regularly enough. And that, admittedly, is a bit too much to bear. What you want is a bit of a yarn, some escapism. Why not? So, why not transpose this action to, say, the deep south of America in the time of the Civil War?
Cavalier Attitudes by Catherine Hardy.
Instead of the supermarket car park, there's a battle raging just down the road from the abandoned plantation. Missy has gone off her head and run screaming through the corn. The general has lost both his legs and sits on a cot in his mangled tent, clutching a bottle in one hand and a blood-stained map in the other. The lads on either side are innocent dupes to forces beyond their control. Most of them have barely learned to shave. It's chaos. Pure and simple. Yet somehow, noble ideals survive these horrors of war. And the lads wet their razors every sunup and assemble at reveille outside the crippled general's tattered tent. There's pathos here. Real pathos. Sure, it has contemporary relevance, but it's not piled on with the trowel. It's pretty subtle in truth. The title suggests it looks back to the English Civil War, while the action looks forward, boldly and unflinchingly, to the complex intellectual and emotional schisms that are tearing apart contemporary civilization. The writer is ambitious, but the touch is deft, and you're never led astray from the romance that beats at its ox-strong heart. It's a telling and timely story of love, race, and betrayal. Everyone speaks in slightly unconvincing transatlantic accents. There's a brutal encounter up at the burnt-out mansion. The Confederates arrive. One of them is quite sensitive. Turns out, he knew her dad way back when the old man was a slave. What's going on here, Georgia May? Lord sakes, what's going on? They stare at one another across the detritus of the cotton field, where one day they'll build a vast and prosperous city. He's sensitive, all right. Perhaps he is the cavalier of the title, a weeping cavalier. His sweetheart is back home, the angel. But she doesn't know she's his sweetheart. Or she's his wife, and she's waiting for him with their bonny daughter, who would be about her age. He says would be, because he hasn't seen her since the war began. She must have forgotten what he looks like. What with his risible beard that he's been growing, and him, a sergeant in the Confederate Army. Naturally, all of a sudden, he wants to reach out to her, to this girl he encounters with all of her ill fortune. She reminds him of the other one. Of course she does. Naturally, he wants to reach out and touch her. That is what you might reasonably expect.
Do you love me?
I like you. I like you a lot.
But do you love me?
But you're not really gonna sit through all this muck, even though you want to know what happens in the end. This would be too much to bear. What you really want is something that speaks to the daily realities of your own life, but in an expressive and meaningful way. Am I right, or am I right?
Among the Warrior Tribe, by Benedict Foy.
Now this one, you have to admit, you supposed was set in Papua New Guinea. A telling and timely story of love, race and betrayal among the lost people of some untouched and endless forest. There's a whole bunch of them speaking pidgin, and you can't understand half of it. There's a brutal encounter up at the big house, and it's not just the pig gets killed. The government investigator arrives, eventually. It takes 6 weeks on foot to reach this desolate and frankly forbidding spot. He's a sensitive soul. Turns out he knew the dead man way back when, before they stopped eating human flesh. And their customs, being what they are, he's somehow beholden to the daughter. They stare at one another across the detritus of an entire culture. His wife is waiting for him back home. No, her feeling towards him are tepid nowadays. But he's getting on a bit, and he's happy with companionship. He reads his Bible and so on and so forth. Yes, their sweet darling daughter is her age. What's that got to do with anything? Is she trying to throw him off the scent? Your expectations are dashed. The story is actually set in the commuter belt south of London, not Papua New Guinea at all. The title is ironic. It's about a bunch of frankly pretty, feckless, and self-obsessed young businessmen who get together at weekends to indulge in some sort of secret society. You're meant to think that they may be football hooligans, or Satanists, or something a little more outlandish that's got no name. Or maybe they're suicide bombers. That would be almost right up to date. Yeah, really contemporary. The author's pretty ambitious. You've noticed his name in a magazine somewhere. Maybe one of those photo shoots where 10 of the hottest young intellectual business or artistic properties in the city are gathered together to pose like a lost generation in a hotel lobby. Each individually dressed by some swanky high street shop, draped oh so casually over the settees and those big armchairs. One or two lounging up against a marble fireplace. All broody, self-confident and suave. And now, he's dropping clues here and there, this bright young thing of a writer, as to what these lads are up to. One of them, one of the lads in the story, hints broadly that in fact the society is devoted to good deeds. The whole thing is shrouded in mystery, mystery with a bit of moral fibre, but a mystery made all more dense and impenetrable by the curious banality of the conversations. More properly, the badly cobbled together, but still adjacent monologues that you overhear.
My name is Patrick, and I'm the general manager of this shop. My team and I meet every morning. We discuss the comments you've made, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If we can deal with it ourselves, we will. If we can't, I'll forward your comments to Jeremy Fowler back at the office. I know he'll do what he can. If you have a minute, please do not hesitate to speak to me or one of my team. Thank you.
And so it limps on. For what seems like an age, kind of stuff you think were taken off the back of a postcard in a sandwich chain. For a moment, you even begin to wish you were back on that plantation. Somewhere in the midst of this farrago of incoherent nonsense, a pair of these more or less entirely uninteresting people meet on the platform, and the plot signals in its own clumsy way that romance is in the offing. The woman is serious about coffee. The man expresses a passion for baguettes. What is it with this catering motif? Who in Christ's name has a passion for baguettes?
Do you love me?
I like you. I like you a lot, innit?
But do you love me?
Anyhow, as is the convention nowadays, an inordinately large amount of the action takes place on mobile phones, so that the writer can fast forward the narrative when the details are becoming too confused and can dispense with background and depth generally. All that is required is a semblance of the gestural drawn from quotidian reality and transposed to this unlikely and unconvincing fiction in a feeble attempt to bring it to life.
Yeah, I can hear you, you sound good. Yeah, I'm on the train, mate. Okay. So, that bloke stop? Yeah? I've never heard of Shaw. Yeah.
You don't pretend to be following it anymore. You only know that by the time of the denouement, a term used merely to flatter all concerned, you'll have long since lost what feeble grip you ever had on the narrative.
Yeah, I can hear you, you sound good. Yeah. Yeah, all good, mate, all good. Loud and clear, yeah, I'm still on the train. Yeah.
You think you're pretty smart, don't you? You're on the train. It's night. You talk into a mobile phone. You tosser. So what? That you're on the train. What f***ing train?
What was she like?
Oh, she was like you, a little. About your height, your weight, even shared your dress sense. Those slippers you're wearing, Primark, aren't they? She'd approve. Never wanted to worry about what the label said, so long as she liked what she saw and bought it when she saw it.
and good too when it came to spotting our trends set in the glossy zone at Paris Fashion Week were translated into affordable clothing down the high street. Of course, her build helped. She could always carry the latest styles, no matter how far they were tailored, to suit the figure of whichever model was in vogue that season. Did I tell you she resembled you?
You haven't seen her. Since these slippers went out of favor with the power elite of fashion, I mean, after all, they're rather old.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't seen her in donkey's years. Not since Margaret Thatcher saw the miners off. And the last time, well, that was when she was down at the bus station, waiting for the National Express to pull in. Dressed in black Dr. Martin boots, black fishnet tights, black Topshop miniskirt. And this coat that was like a khaki army kind of thing, but with elaborate scarlet piping that indicated that wasn't your military clobber at all. Big tea cozy hat plonked on her head, touched with polystyrene, dated, huh? I was doing surveillance, a big undercover job involving a local politician, real scumbag. Drug smuggling, rent boys, the IRA, offshore money laundering, a lot. Taking months to piece together so I couldn't do anything, just had to sit there in the back of the van with all these tellies and tape recorders and what have you, and watch her board that coach. I'd have done anything to prevent her leaving. Anything.
And yet you did let her leave. You let her leave.
I had to. I had a job to do. I had to, for crying out loud.
And so on and so forth. There's endless hours of this stuff. Who did what to whom? How? Why? Where? What on earth could be the point of it? Endless torrents of information. Surely it would be more pertinent if the narrative acted as a filter, one that boiled down all other possible narratives, the infinite number of narratives out there, into one overriding story that made all the rest redundant. Then we could all move on. Better still, why not abandon narrative altogether? Embrace digression. Just let it flow and ebb. Go along with it gently, ignore it, come back to it, or not. Or state, once and for all, that what is really important is merely to achieve certain effects in an expressionistic or impressionistic way. A post-expressionistic way. As it is, one is given the decided impression that whoever is coming up with this stuff has made precious little effort to pace it, to think it through, or to figure out a decent ending, let alone attempt to make it pertinent or even amusing. The audience sits through it. They clutch at straws and hug handful after handful of clunking cliches to their breasts. They'll tolerate the gaping holes in the plot so long as the acting isn't entirely without merit, and so long as they can recognise a tiny part of themselves in the drama. They allow it to plod on. They have to acquiesce, have to. They are as much a part of it as the actors or the fictional characters the actors are supposed to be playing. Without it, they wouldn't exist, so we have to go on. To just stop wouldn't merely be a disappointment. It would be an affront. Sure, the audience wouldn't let it get to them, but it would still be an affront.
Yes, there was a time when I would have believed you, but you're weak. Weak like all men, weak and totally unreliable. The unmitigated relief of a broken heart. It works wonders. You should try it.
Listen, Tracy, we're alone now. For God's sake, let's give up this pretense.
I don't know what you mean, Inspector.
Chief Inspector, look, my name's Colin. Colin, not so hard to say, is it?
What is it you want me to say exactly, Colin?
Oh, come on, woman. We haven't got time for this. I'll be back any moment. Are you really telling me you don't know? It was you all along who tipped off Mr. Big. That Irish rent boy he was caught with turned out to be working for MI5 the whole time. He wasn't really the son of the ex-informer out for personal justice. He was professional, just like you or me. Do you think I'm stupid or something? I spotted you straight off. That story about the running in the car park. Just a smokescreen thrown up by whoever it is who's running this whole operation. Now you've got to tell me. You've got to. My daughter's life depends upon this. You must see that. She didn't want to leave. She was forced out by your boss, the same person who killed my wife. Surely there's some ounce of humanity left inside you. Surely you cannot continue with this endless cycle of violence, this charade.
I do what I'm told. I'm not proud of what I do. I have no choice. See, I once made a vow. A vow in which I promised, on pain of death, to follow the dictates of a secret society. One that I thought was devoted to good. Oh, I see now that I was a fool, young and headstrong. But still I made the vow, and I cannot escape. I have no choice.
But you have, Tracy. Come away with me. Come away with me now. We can blow the lid on this whole setup and start afresh. Don't tell me you don't want to.
But the past. And then there is your daughter.
She's gone for good. I may be a man, all right, but I'm no fool. You can't spend all your life raking over the coals of what if, and you can't live your life looking over your shoulder.
I can't. I can't, Colin.
Look, the past is to the past. I've never told anyone this before, Tracy. And I'm only telling you now because I can see I don't have any other option. In a previous lifetime, I was the son of the Queen of Madagascar, sold into slavery by my half-brother, can you believe? And transported to the colony of West Virginia. A man freed me during the Civil War, a great man. That man was Abraham Lincoln, the President of the United States, one of the greatest men who ever walked this earth. And in return for my freedom, I taught him the secrets of sex magic, passed down to me by my mother, the aged queen, a very, very wise woman who had inherited this knowledge from her forebears, a people lost in the fastnesses of that impenetrable forest of tradition and esoteric ancestral lore. It was through me that this arcane knowledge was filtered into what we now know as Western culture and...
Stop it, Colin. Stop it. You don't have to tell me these things. Can't you see that every fiber in my being wants to go with you? Wants to go with you now and...
Yeah. Anyway, as I was saying about Shaw, yeah. But no one else... would ever know I'm speaking to you, right? Yeah. Well, on the day that I phoned you, No, I've got his name with someone else. Yeah, he's left us now. Oh, has he? Oh, they kicked him out. Yeah, he was safe. Yeah, plus I've got my 2K pay rise as well. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah, all right. Well, I thought you were pretty good at IT, weren't you? Oh, it's the one. Yeah, it can be, mate. Yeah, it can be a bit boring, a bit mundane. Yeah, I've done it myself. Yeah, it's mundane, boring, rubbish. Yeah, just don't do it. The money's... You get the right company. If you get the right company, you can make some serious money. Serious. Sorry, mate. Sorry, I can't hear you. Call me Taylor, eh? I say your mum loves Sean.
And so on, and so on, and so on, and so on.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radio.fm. Over and out.